Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Well, here it is. Supply may have finally caught up with demand for new condominiums in Miami. Real estate here in South Florida has been running hot for several years, and parts of the housing market remain red hot even today. Single-family homes keep climbing in value across the region, as do prices for existing condominiums and townhomes. The median prices of those up 8% in May compared to a year ago. But for brand new condominiums in Miami, prices are flopping for flippers. There are fewer cash buyers, fewer foreign buyers. That's slowed down considerably. But the housing market beyond the new beach condos is, well, if not still booming, it's certainly not going bust, according to the data. So real estate is where we begin this edition of the Florida Roundup. Are you trying to buy or sell or rent a home in South Florida? Share your experiences with us. Are the lower prices we're seeing for new condominiums in Miami a canary in the coal mine for the South Florida housing market in the months to come? And how do home prices impact local governments and services in your community? 800-743-WLRN. Buy, sell, or rent housing. 800-743-9576, the telephone number. You can also send us a tweet with your experiences at WLRN on Twitter. Brian Bandel covers real estate for the South Florida Business Journal, out with the cover story this week. Paul Ours covers real estate in Palm Beach and Broward counties for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. He's with us on the telephone. Brian, here, describe the new condominium market today in August in Miami.
Well, we have thousands of condominiums under construction, thousands more that were recently delivered. But a lot of the people who bought condos that were delivered since 2015 are finding disappointment when they try and sell them. The majority of the buyers were investors, a lot from Latin America. A lot of those who were trying to sell at a profit have taken a loss. For instance, in Icon Bay condo in Miami's Edgewater, 21 units were flipped, 12 sold for a loss, means the sellers paid less than what they got less than what they originally paid the developer for those units. So I think they're finding that flipping condos is not always profitable.
And flipping a condo is selling something you bought within a couple of years. Is that how you describe a flipper?
Yeah, generally a couple of years. A lot of times they bought it with the intention of selling it quickly. According to Jack McCabe, a real estate analyst, 30-40% of condos in recently completed buildings are immediately put on the market for sale once the buildings are done.
So we'll find out how specific this is to specific buildings in a moment, but let me bring in Paul Ours with the South Florida Sun Sentinel real estate reporter. Paul, the kind of price depreciation that Brian reports in Miami, any sense that that is also happening in the new condominium market in Broward and Palm Beach?
Well, it's definitely a different story with the condo markets up here in Broward and Palm Beach. The supply of units, you know, in these two counties is nowhere near what it is in Miami-Dade. So there's still a lot of optimism that the markets here can absorb more condos.
So you're not seeing the prices move lower then?
I'm sorry?
So you're not seeing those prices for the new product move lower in Broward and Palm Beach?
No, the condo prices continue to increase along with single family. So there really has been a very strong market up here for the last several years.
Brian, how does it compare and contrast? Is this really a supply issue?
Yeah, it's about supply because there's been a lot of development in particular neighborhoods. And it's not happening to every neighborhood. I mean, it's happening a lot in Brickell, in Edgewater, in Sunny Isles Beach, where there's been a ton of development. The only place in Broward where there's been a lot of development is sort of coastal Hollywood, Hallandale. But even then, it's only a few buildings. It's not the thousands of units like we have in Miami-Dade. And anytime you have new development, the recently completed condos are going to compete with the new condos that are being in pre-sales, and that's what's putting a lot of strain on prices.
And what about financing? Is that putting a strain on prices as well? Still difficult to get a mortgage for a condominium in Miami, for instance?
Well, financing comes into the play as it limits the availability, the number of people who could buy it. So I could afford a mortgage for a $350,000 single-family home, mm-hmm. but I could get a federal housing administration loan. I could put like 2% down, and I could afford the mortgage. But if I want a condo, very few condos in South Florida qualify for FHA loans, so I would have to put over 20% down. I may not have that cash. I may not have, you know, $80,000 in cash sitting around. And if I did, I probably wouldn't want something that was $350,000. I'd probably buy something for more. So that means that this is mostly limiting the market to foreign investors. And there's only so many foreign investors out there, especially when, you know, economies in South America have some, you know, issues.
Yeah, particularly Brazil, which had been a key source of South Florida Brickell buyers and South Florida Miami-Dade real estate buyers after the housing collapse. What are you experiencing in your home market? Have you seen more homes for sale in your neighborhood or your building? Are you looking to buy or to rent? 800-743-WLRN. Brian Bandel of the South Florida Business Journal with us. So he covers real estate for the Journal, and Paul Hours covers real estate in Broward and Palm Beach County for the Sun Sentinel. 800-743-9576. Paul, we talk about a lot fewer new condominium developments in Broward and Palm Beach compared to Dade County. Why is that, as we've seen populations in all three counties continue to expand since the housing collapse finished, 7 years or so ago?
Right. Well, Miami has always been the epicenter for South Florida, and developers have always been attracted to Miami and downtown Miami. Broward and Palm Beach are considered more secondary markets, and so you haven't seen as much development up here as you have down there. Now, that has started to change. As Miami gets built out, you're seeing more developers coming up here into Broward and Palm Beach. You know, certainly Hallandale and Hollywood have seen their fair share of development, but it's just not quite as big of a market as, say, Miami.
And what about the market for buyers? How are those different with those developments in Broward and Palm Beach that perhaps hasn't been so hot as the market for buyers and sellers in Miami-Dade?
Well, we've seen fewer international investors coming in and buying it. The market now is more toward the domestic buyers. And analysts that I've talked to say that, you know, as long as the stock market continues to thrive, domestic buyers who are, you know, driving these sales will still feel wealthy and want to continue investing. You know, there's nothing on the horizon that would suggest a downturn is looming.
Have we seen a change in the profile of the buyers in Dade County, Brian, because of the slowdown we've seen in Latin American economies over the past 24 months?
Well, a lot of Dade County buyers are trying to get buyers from the Northeast. They're registering in New York to sell condos there. They're reaching out to Europe, to China, to Turkey. So, and some of them have had success. I know the Paramount World Center condo has had some success with China and with Turkey. It's not easy, though, because those are new markets. They're not as familiar with Miami. Yep. So it takes a lot more work. And then I guess you have to have the question, can you sell it to them as something they will use or as an investment? Because if you're selling it as an investment and you see the track record of what's happening to these current investors, you have to say, is this the smartest way to invest my money?
If you've looked at it over 10 years, it's been a pretty good return on investment. But the 2 years that you detail in your reporting, Brian, for some of these brand new condominium buildings on the waterfront in Miami, not a great return on investment.
Well, it depends when you bought it. If you bought it at the peak of the last boom, if you bought it, say, in 2007 before the market crashed, I don't know if those have recovered prices. On the mainland Miami, they haven't. Miami Beach, they're above. But like if you paid top dollar for a Brickell condo to 2007, you may not quite have recovered that yet. You might still a little bit short of that. If you bought in 2010, say, when things had bottomed out, then you're still feeling very good right now.
So when did you buy? Are you looking to buy or sell? Get out now at a top, perhaps, or looking to get in? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, real estate, blood sport in South Florida. Let's begin in West Palm Beach, where Richard joins us. Richard, you're on the radio. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I'm really always looking at the market, and I'm transplant from Chicago, and I saw how Chicago has lost a huge population, part of it to Florida. My question is about buying in South Florida, particularly in the Miami market, the concern of global warming. And, you know, we've all heard about how the sea levels are coming up. The last program just talked about New Orleans being flooded and having problems with pumps. Why would someone want to buy in South Beach or in an area where we know that the temperature is changing, we're out of the Paris climate, and we want to invest money in South Florida, even though it's a wonderful place, the weather changes very strong for us? How can we take all of these factors and put them together in looking at what's happening with the real estate market?
Richard, good question. Brian, you want to tackle that one?
Well, clearly our cities have to invest a lot of money to mitigate what's happening with global warming and sea level rise. Miami Beach has started the investment, but they have to invest more. We saw what happened last Tuesday when there was a couple hours of heavy rain still flooding in Miami Beach. And near where I work in Brickell, there was a tremendous amount of flooding around Mary Brickell Village on Southwest 7th Street. I mean, just from a few hours of rain, it became very difficult. So we have to invest a lot in the drainage system and the sewage system. And if we don't, then the real estate, it's not going to be very accessible in the future.
The city of Miami is talking about, will be putting on the ballot this November, a $400 million bond referendum asking to borrow that much money. And I think two-thirds of that, Brian, is directed at sustainability and climate change-type projects. But it also relies on rising property values to help pay for borrowing that money to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to hit us all in the wallet. It's a situation that can be addressed, at least, you know, in the short term over the next 20, 30 years, but it's going to cost a lot of money to address it.
And Paul Hours with the Sun Sentinel, Richard is calling from West Palm Beach. Palm Beach County recently got new flood maps, and thousands of properties learned that if they carry a mortgage, they now have to go out and buy flood insurance for the first time, perhaps, that they've ever had the deed to the home.
Right. The flood insurance has been optional, and people are not used to having to acquire this. So it's been an issue up here and will continue to be an issue, I think, as we go forward into the years ahead.
Boca Raton is up next. Chuck, you are on the radio. Welcome. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. My question has to do with country club residential communities are having a tough time selling their houses because new buyers, including millennials, are not willing to ante up $100,000, $150,000 on the mandatory membership golf and tennis club fees, which have to be financed in cash. They cannot be mortgaged. They can't take out a loan for those. So my question is, what are the prospects for these country club sales here that are really declining?
Good question.
And what do you? I wrote about this on my website, if I could mention it.
Chuck, well, hold on. Let me let Brian answer here this first. This is the cost of ownership with some type of specific products that can be unique here in South Florida, right on the golf course or right next to the tennis court.
Yes, I wrote about this subject last year in a story called Developer Swing for the Green. A lot of these golf courses are getting sold for redevelopment for single-family homes, because they're costing a lot to maintain, and a lot of these communities are having to spend a lot of money on maintenance, fixing up the greens and the ponds. And yes, it is a challenge. I think if you're in a golf club community, they can either say, well, we double down, we invest in it, we make it nicer so people will pay to be part of it, or you know what, let's just scrap it, we'll sell it to a developer, let them build homes here, and you know, forget about, you know, get rid of the fees.
Yeah.
But it's tough. Some have also said, well, you know what, let's open it up to the community so you don't have to be a member, and we'll try and get more members that way. Because think about it, they have a restaurant. The restaurant is for like the 300 people who own homes there.
Right.
You're not really making money in that restaurant.
Right.
It's a loss leader, you know,
yeah.
And that's the challenge they have in a lot of these communities.
Paul, your experience with golf clubs and tennis clubs and those kind of HOA, homeowners association fees in Broward and Palm Beach.
Sure. I actually have a story up today about a development at Boca West Country Club in West Boca. There's a developer who has bought land there and is building luxury condos inside the country club. And one of the problems that analysts see with that is that they, in addition to these pricey condos, which are about $1 million up to $3 million, they have to pay for membership fees. And I think Boca West is $70,000. That's a one-time fee that they have to pay up front in addition to the cost of the condo. There's also social dues that run about $1,000 a month. So the analysts think that people who are interested in that lifestyle, there's just not a lot of them. And it used to be the way people would come to South Florida and want to invest in these communities. We saw during the housing bust that those kind of communities really struggled.
Yeah.
And even as the market has recovered, those communities really are still having a tough time.
Real estate in South Florida is up first here on the Florida Roundup. Your comments, what are you experiencing? Buy, sell, or rent? 800-743-9576. Brian Bandel with the South Florida Business Journal details some price erosion when it comes to condominium flippers for new condominiums in Miami-Dade. Paul Hours covers real estate for the South Florida Sun Sentinel in Broward and Palm Beach County. Brian, is your reporting, are you finding any echoes of the price erosion in the new condominium market, any echoes of what this community experienced 10 years ago?
No, and that's the good news, is we're not headed for a major real estate bust like we had a decade ago. The main reason is this is not financed by loans. You know, and the last time we had, you know, people who were plumbers buying five condos, putting down 10% deposits on each, they were getting loans where they just wrote their income on a napkin basically and said, oh, this is how much I make without verifying. We don't have that this time. These units have 50% deposits for the most part. So even if their value went down, say, 10%, it doesn't make sense to walk away from a 50% deposit. And they're mostly closing in cash. So even if they overpaid a little bit and the value was down, there's not a bank breathing down their neck forcing them to sell.
So the foreclosures you're not seeing, you're not sensing. These are closed real estate deals that are just happening at lower prices than what the original buyer purchased.
Yes, and if you look at the bank reporting, we're seeing foreclosure rates very low, almost at a 10-year low, and we're also seeing the local banks, they're not foreclosing on real estate projects very often either. That's low too. The only condo projects that have really gotten in trouble are the ones that haven't broken ground, where it's a land loan issue. Mostly when a developer starts construction, they're able to complete because they have 50% of the cost paid in cash deposits.
Yep. All right. Real estate here continues in North Miami Beach. Robert, you are on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Robert.
Hey, how are you? Thank you. My son and I are at Home Depot right now getting stuff to fix up my wife's condo, who she cannot sell because the homeowners association, somebody bought two properties in her condo association, and now they are not allowing first-time buyers. How is that possible?
And they're not allowing FHA loans. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Right.
In other words, anybody who comes to pay, they have to have at least, I think, 20%.
Yep.
Down,
yep.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't understand how, if my wife bought this right out of college and now she's, you know, has a chance to make some money off of it,
mm-hmm.
to pay off her student loans or whatever, she cannot do that.
Robert, let me put this to the panel here. And just to be clear, it's not, our guess is the association is not denying first-time buyers. It's that it is not, if a buyer has to get a mortgage, so they have to borrow money, they can't borrow money and have that mortgage essentially align with Federal Housing Administration guidelines and be able to get the full guarantee backing of certain federal government programs. Is that about right, Brian?
Yes. The FHA has a limit on the number of investor-owned units in a building. So if there are too many units in a condo that are owned by investors, the FHA says, I'm not making loans anymore in this condo, so you can't go have like a 2% down first-time buyer loan. You have to go with another program where you need 20% down, and that issue is something that they need to deal with in Washington about how should we amend these rules? Because after the last housing bust, they changed these rules and made them a lot more strict, and that's been causing a problem. Why at the average a home buyer, they might be able to paying a $2,500 rent on a unit, but they couldn't buy a unit and pay the same amount of a mortgage because they don't have what down. The FHA won't approve these buildings. That's one of the big issues that's blocking a lot of deals.
So, Robert, let me ask you, in this condominium that you're getting some drywall or paint for right now as we speak to you, are you able to rent it out? Do you have any interest in that?
That's what we're forced to do. Hmm. That's the unfortunate part, is that my realtor is telling me, listen, you have to try to find a renter, and we, luckily enough, find a renter who is willing to take, you know, the 60-day warning penalty fee and all that, and is willing to move into this condo. And yeah, and the thing is, if you're an investor, it would be a great deal, because we're going to make way more money than we pay for the mortgage, but we still have the headache of renting.
You still got to be a landlord, Robert. Welcome to a new line of business there, right?
Exactly. And yeah. Now the reason we're getting drywall is because of the last renters. You know what I mean?
We understand. I think we can all certainly sympathize with you.
And I really appreciate the fact that the lady mentioned that we need to go to Washington and change that law, because that's unfair. That one guy comes in, buys two units, and now my wife can't sell her place.
That's regulations, absolutely, Robert. That was Brian Bandel from the South Florida Business Journal who mentioned that. Talking about real estate, one comment on the Twitter feed at WLRN from Lisa saying it has been a nightmare trying to buy a house. A lot of questions and confusing issues around financing, around affordability problems here. Iris is joining the Florida Roundup from Miami. Iris, you are on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Big question, again, is the condominium market that we're having here in South Florida, or primary home. We have, what house goes listed, and you have 5-6 people, you know, putting contracts on that house or the condominium, and although we know it's not going to appraise, you know, people are offering more and more, and it's very difficult for the people that live here in Miami to compete with the investors that are coming in with cash.
Iris, good question. Are we still experiencing that, Brian? I mean, you've detailed in your reporting some of the price drops and the new product in specific buildings. But Iris is talking just, you know, in the neighborhoods that we all live in South Florida.
Yes. Well, I believe, Iris, you're talking about single-family homes, right?
Iris, single-family homes, is that right?
That is correct.
Yes. Single-family homes is actually a much stronger market right now. And it had the other side of supply and demand. There's just not a lot of places to build new single-family homes. The population is increasing. So the demand for your existing single-family homes is going up. And so that is causing people to pay more and more money for these homes. And so it's good if you own one. It can make it tough if you're trying to buy one. So people who are buying are going to farther markets. One of the main market, like, for instance, Homestead, Cutler Bay, those are actually where most of the single-family home transactions are taking place. They're farther, but they're affordable, at least.
And this dynamic, Brian, that you're talking about isn't exclusive to Dade County. Paul Hours with the Sun Sentinel, we've seen that in Broward County with single-family home prices continuing to increase, and in Palm Beach County with single-family home prices continuing to increase, especially in that median price area, that kind of below $500,000 or $400,000.
Right, yeah, the median prices in all three South Florida counties right now are well above $300,000. And that's making affordability, you know, an increasingly, big issue throughout the region. In fact, a few months ago, I wrote a story about a lot of people in Broward, a lot of workers who feel the need to move out to Collier County on the west coast of Florida, in a development there called Ave Maria. And they are driving more than an hour back and forth to their jobs, but they're doing it simply because prices over there are much more reasonable.
You'd be spending a lot of time on Alligator Alley in that regard. What about the rental market here? With so much activity still happening on the buy side in single-family homes, some of the price drop on the new condominium side, the rental market still is very, very tight, isn't it, Brian?
Yes, there's still a pretty high occupancy rate in rental. There's been talk that the rents in downtown Miami have been going down slightly just because there's been a lot of development. But most most analysts who study apartments saying that the rents continue to go up. There's a lot of construction in that area, too.
Does, you know, what you report in terms of prices flopping for flippers, does that perhaps bode well for renters in the months ahead, that all of these new condominium projects will be coming to market? There won't be enough buyers, so the owners of them are going to have to look to put heads in bed somewhere, and the rental market would be the natural place to look, like Robert's doing with his condominium in North Miami Beach.
Yeah, I mean, if they can't sell them, you're right. They'll have to rent them for a while. The issue is whether these condo rents can be competitive with the traditional apartments that are being developed. Because remember, if you have a condo rent, you have to also pay your association dues and pass that on to the renter. In some cases, these associations are the equivalent to $1 a square foot. So if you're renting a 1,000 square foot unit, you're paying $1,000 in maintenance to the association. And that's a lot to take out of your profit on renting a condo to someone.
And, of course, the cost to carry, the maintenance, the drywall repairs, as Robert's experiencing shared with us. But, Paul, also the property taxes. This is, new real estate especially is a key source of growing revenue for local governments. So how are they looking at these kinds of dynamics that are happening in the housing market?
Well, the local governments are, I think are thrilled with the amount of construction that's going on because, the more construction happens, the more money that comes into the counties. So definitely the building boom that we've seen over the last few years on the condo side and now with apartments, That's definitely good news for local governments.
That is Paul Auers, real estate reporter for the Sun Sentinel. Paul, thank you so much for sharing your comments and expertise with us today on the Roundup. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Bandel writing the cover story for this week's South Florida Business Journal on prices flopping for flippers. Brian, great to have you back on the Roundup as well.
Thank you very much.
Stick around. Plenty more to come. Did you see that video recently of a shark being dragged behind a high-speed boat? It's just the latest case of mistreating wildlife. What more can and should be done to protect Florida's wild things? Let us know your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN. As the Roundup continues, 800-743-9576. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening. There's the video of a man on the back deck of a fishing boat firing a handgun into what looks like a wounded shark swimming nearby. And there's a second video posted on social media showing another man pouring a beer into the mouth of a just-caught fish. Instagram posts with men holding a giant white pelican by its wings. These are all over social media, but this is the one video that went viral.
Look, it's already almost there.
In the wake of a boat is a shark tied with a rope to the stern, bouncing along in the water. It has led to a state fish and wildlife conservation investigation here in Florida. Stories of mistreating wildlife are not all that uncommon, ranging from the illegal swimming with manatees to, yes, even the illegal killing of alligators. Now, earlier this month, in fact, three men were arrested in the Keys, accused of hogtying three key deer and stuffing them into a trunk. So how do we protect wildlife in Florida? Have you witnessed wildlife cruelty? What should and can be done? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, how we treat the wild things in South Florida. Jenny Stiletovich writes about the environment for our partner, the Miami Herald, and she joins us from our studios inside its newsroom in Doral. Jenny, what is the latest on the shark video investigation?
Right now, state Fish and Wildlife officers are still investigating. No charges have been filed yet. They haven't even actually confirmed the names of the guys involved, but they're continuing their investigation. This week, I spoke to one of the agents up there who said they couldn't really say how long it would take because it's complicated.
The video is brutal. Frankly, in the way that this boat is speeding along almost at full plane with this essentially a body of a shark being dragged by its fin. Is there a crime that's depicted in that video?
Well, there are several crimes that could have been committed. They don't know what species of shark it is yet, although I think some people have said it's a black tip, which would not have been protected. Mm-hmm. There are animal cruelty laws. There's something called wanton waste, where if you kill wildlife and then just toss it away without using it for food or whatever, that violates a state law. I think the difficulty is going to be figuring out when and where it happened. Although, if they have the video, there's metadata that can be traced in that.
Wasn't there an earlier state investigation into some of the guys who are potentially alleged to have been involved in this shark video incident?
Right. So there were complaints made about them. I think it was in August 2015 mm-hmm. to state officials. The state has a hotline, and so there are multiple pictures out there, and people complained about them. The state tracked it down, found pictures of these guys holding up birds, which is a federal violation. The Migratory Bird Act is handled by the feds and not the state. So they contacted U.S. Fish and Wildlife, which took the lead on the investigation. They looked into it for about a year. They tracked down witnesses. They tried to talk to the guys. They tried to retrace the steps to figure out where the pictures were taken. Ultimately, they closed the case because they couldn't determine when exactly it happened, according to the records I got, which were not complete, by the way.
Not complete in terms of?
Well, I think what I got was just a summary of their case file. So the full extent of the investigation, I'm not sure what all they did exactly.
So how do you describe these videos? You've been around the environment, reported on the environment and wildlife for a good long time. These cases of folks wanting to swim with manatees, for instance, you know, that's something that is clearly illegal and discouraged, more friendly, obviously, than dragging a shark behind a speeding boat. But how do you describe some of these posts that you've seen in your reporting?
Well, I mean, the posts associated with this particular case, I mean, there's a level of cruelty, I think, that is you don't see with people trying to pet manatees or give them fresh water.
Right.
I mean, some of the things that were posted were pretty horrible. I mean, it's kind of like the bro culture, you know, just kind of, but worse. And so I think that's what really outraged people. And it extended, you know, a lot of these things that I cover on the environmental beat will oftentimes, you know, raise the ire of like animal lovers and stuff. But anglers were also outraged by this. I mean, I'm married into a family of anglers. It goes back generations.
Yeah, right.
And so, I mean, we have this tradition of, you know, I'm not an expert on fishing, but one thing I know is that if fishermen love one thing more than catching fish, it's taking pictures of themselves catching fish. So this tradition of taking pictures goes back, you know, you used to be able to drive down to the Keys and stop by the tackle shops and the walls would be lined with pictures.
As long as photography has been invented, it has been married with fishing, and especially big game fishing and ocean fishing. We've all seen, you know, those pictures of Hemingway and the docks in Key West with, you know, big marlins and those kinds of things.
Right. But the regulations have evolved over the years, as you know, South Florida became like the mecca of fishing, and there was more and more pressure on fish. The anglers started developing regulations for things that they knew they didn't want to stress out the fish. So, for instance, you can't pull a tarpon into a boat anymore to have your picture taken with it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, there is a movement to be more, you know, careful in how you fish. These guys went well beyond, you know, what would be considered, you know, I think, decent by most anglers.
Jenny Seletovich covers the environment for a part of the Miami Herald. We're talking about that now infamous viral shark dragging video behind a deck of a boat. And this, we think, Jenny, investigators think it happened in the Gulf of Mexico. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So not locally here in South Florida in the Gulf Coast, but nonetheless, investigation continues. 800-743-9576, protecting the wild things in Florida. Giselle is in Miami Shores today. Giselle, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My perspective is that you can make legislation for these issues, and that certainly may help. But particularly when people are out in nature, they may think nobody is going to see. And I think the real essence that needs to be considered is, how do we instill in people respect for life, plant life, animal life, the life of the planet, and life for people, for that matter?
Giselle, those are big questions here. I'm not sure we're quite prepared, Jenny, you and I, to tackle those alone. But the idea, the morality of what's being depicted here, you know, Giselle has a point. 20 years ago, these would have been just snapshots shared among friends. But because the advent of social media, this kind of mistreatment, maltreatment, brutal treatment of animals is shared with the world and allows the kind of investigations that that police are now have launched here, isn't it?
Yes, and I think people's reaction, the widespread negative reaction, is one way to sort of instill that respect for wildlife. I think other people see this and realize, I mean, this, again, it goes well beyond what these guys did was, you know, was pretty cruel. I don't, but and I think almost everybody would recognize, like, whoa, this is not a way to catch a shark.
Certainly. And you don't have to be a fisherman to certainly see the kind of mistreatment that's on display with that video. But it was earlier this month when three guys were arrested in the Lower Keys when they had three key deer hogtied and stuffed into the trunk of their car. And they, I believe those key deer wound up having to be euthanized.
One of them did have to be euthanized. Yeah. And I mean, you know, I don't know what to say. There's always going to be idiots who do something awful that, you know, that's nothing new. In a way, it helps that social media draws a spotlight to it. More people find out.
And you know, while certainly not the brutal treatment of animals, just the respect and the acknowledgement of the place of wild things in our environment here. You were detailing in some reports just a week or so ago about the continued disappearance of the conch in South Florida. You know, some of this could be environmental, but we've also seen cases in Key West this summer of tourists wandering into the beach and finding, you know, these big, beautiful conchs and trying to take them with them as souvenirs.
Right. I mean, every day I try and write stories that alerts people to the pressures that there are down here on wildlife. When a place has so many people and so little wild areas left, it's just going to be a lot more fragile than in other places.
Christopher is joining our conversation from Hollywood. Christopher, you are on the radio. Go ahead.
Hey there, how you doing? So really and truly, it really boils down to more than just animals, really, because any kind of cruelty is cruelty. And if you're going to be cruel, it just doesn't add up. It's like if there was a lion out there and you were in the wild versus the lion would eat you. He wouldn't torture you. Torturing is not a good behavior. It's an unacceptable behavior, actually. And trust me, I come from Jamaica, a place where hunting I've been doing for a long time. And my father always taught me to whatever I kill, I must eat. And if I kill it, make sure it dies with ease.
Christopher, we appreciate the thoughts there. Christopher from Hollywood joining us here on the Roundup. So what's next in this shark video investigation, Jenny? Just trying to identify positive identification of those depicted in it?
I think they've been identified. I think probably what state wildlife agents are doing is putting together a case that they think is solid enough to file charges and take to court.
And you know, from the bigger picture, the point you were making earlier about the sensitivity to wildlife here, you know, this is a place that a lot of folks who are listening now call home, and it's a place whose economy depends upon a lot of visitors coming who may not necessarily be as aware and as sensitive to the wild things, but these cases that we're talking about here are allegedly perpetrated by folks who live here and work amongst these wild things and the shrinking wild space that we have in Florida.
Right, but for these isolated cases, I think there are far more people who, you know, appreciate what we have and don't behave like this. Christopher had a point about torture. I mean, both the these guys and the Keys incident. Well, the Keys, I don't know if it was about torture or just plain stupidity. I mean,
yeah. Jenny Siletovich, environmental reporter for a partner of the Miami Herald. Jenny, great to have you back on the Roundup again.
Thank you.
Still to come on the program, Coral Gables is looking for critics about vacancies in its police department. It's suing Facebook to find out who they are. So how should a city government go after its social media critics? That's next, 800-743-WLRN for your input. 800-743-9576 as the Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. As always, thanks for listening. Coral Gables has a police problem, critics say, and has for years. Too many vacancies in the police department. In July, it had 10 openings in the department, which may not sound like a lot, but it's about 5% of its budgeted staff for police officers. Now, critics took to social media in May, creating Instagram and Facebook posts going after the city for using private security guards to patrol some neighborhoods. That practice started about a year ago. One post featured a video of a girl being beaten up while security guards watched with the message, quote, "Don't let this happen in Coral Gables." Now, the video did not happen in Coral Gables. It happened in Seattle. In fact, it happened 7 years ago. Coral Gables has now sued Facebook and Instagram, demanding the identities of the people behind the social media accounts. It's City Hall versus social media. Is Coral Gables just protecting its city logo, as it claims? Or does the lawsuit threaten to silence critics of civility? Is the pursuit of social media and social media critics a good use of city resources? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to join the conversation. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. Jessica Lipscomb is a reporter for the Miami New Times who discovered this lawsuit first. Jessica, what is the city of Coral Gables claiming in this lawsuit against Facebook?
Well, what they're claiming is that these social media accounts, both on Facebook and Instagram, sort of disparage the city and put it in a bad light, especially given the fact, as you mentioned, that the one of the videos included on those accounts actually referenced behavior that happened in Seattle instead of Coral Gables. I think it is misleading to citizens.
Describe the posts that are at the center of the lawsuit here.
So the funny thing is it's a little bit tricky to track all of them because some of them have since been deleted. But the remaining account that is on Facebook, which is called Coral Gables Residents Who Care, posted a video saying that I guess Coral Gables is starting to use more security guards instead of police officers. And this person was against that, thinking that that would lead to a decrease in public safety, essentially.
Let's bring in Lance Dixon, who covers Coral Gables for a partner of the Miami Herald. He's with us from our Doral studios. Lance, you heard Jessica refer to the use of security guards in Coral Gables. Talk to us about that. What's happening with the police department?
So in the police department, there's been a movement in the last couple of years to speed up hiring, and it's been something that's been talked about at the city level. There are a lot of engaged citizens who really want to see that practice pick up. So in the interim, as the city is moving new recruits through the academy and trying to step up recruitment efforts, they've utilized different things where they have some part-time officers who work specifically on things like traffic enforcement. And in this particular case, and especially in the northern part of the city, they've brought in these security guards who essentially kind of monitor the area, especially during the daytime when people are away from work and things like that, because the area had a lot of car break-ins and home invasions and robberies and things of that nature. So they basically are just another set of eyeballs in the city's mind. But for residents and some of these critics, they're saying, well, these aren't actual officers. They're patrolling our streets, sure, and they're another set of eyes and ears. But ultimately, if something more dire or serious happened, they don't have guns. They aren't properly trained to handle that the way a police officer would.
They don't have the power to arrest, for instance.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. And so what's the process that the city is going through to address the heart of the criticism? Not the critics themselves, but the heart of the criticism. In other words, these long-lasting vacancies in the police department.
So they've tried to step up their recruitment efforts, and they've done that through various pushes on social media, different videos, kind of trying to just highlight the fact that Coral Gables is not, for example, like New York or some other areas like that where it's colder and things like that, which, you know, is a kind of standard thing,
yeah,
I think, for South Florida law enforcement
agencies. One of the difficulties that the City Hall points to, though, is, you know, finding people who are qualified and finding people who are qualified at the pay rate in, frankly, a place that is pretty expensive to live in.
Sure, sure. And the Gables has made the choice to keep their standards pretty strict, which is another thing that some critics and even some members of the police union have brought up in the past, where they say, look, we need recruits. Obviously, we want the best and we want to try to bring in the best. But if we're knocking people down because they might have had too many speeding tickets on their record, or if they don't have a certain amount of college credits and things of that nature, then we're going to see things continue to stay slow.
Jessica Lipscomb with the Miami New Times. The step that Coral Gables took to sue Facebook and Instagram came after it tried to essentially ask those social media platforms for the identities of the posters. What do they want the identities for? What does the city want the identities of the folks behind the Coral Gables Residents Who Care Facebook page?
Well, according to the lawsuit, they're looking for that information so that they could, it sounds like, take legal action against the person who's actually posting this. So the first step is getting, you know, Instagram and Facebook to hopefully comply if they get what they want. And then it sounds like they would use that information to, you know, go to that person and maybe issue cease and desist letters to them.
And the city claims, as you mentioned, Jessica, in the lawsuit, it doesn't make the claim about the criticism. It's about the use of the Coral Gables emblem or the logo. Is that right?
Well, it seems like it might be both things. They definitely took issue with the use of the emblem, but they're also saying the fact that this poster is publishing a video that didn't even take place in Coral Gables is misleading and kind of gives people the wrong impression of what the current situation is here in the Gables.
City Hall versus social media here on the Roundup, 800-743-9576. Pepe is in Miami. Pepe, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yeah, just want to say that a lot of the times these entities will just spend a lot of taxpayer money on doing these research and these investigations instead of just focusing on the real issues and getting down to the reality of what people really need. And it's just back to community policing and just making relationships out there instead of just, you know, spinning their wheels and spending taxpayer money to do stuff that doesn't really do any good for anyone anyways.
Pepe, we got it. Great point there. Jessica, kind of respond a little bit to that and this idea in the lawsuit that the city claims it could will suffer irreparable harm if it can't determine who's behind these posts.
Yeah, and I think there's a real question about that. I mean, as I mentioned in my story, there were only 9 people that liked this page on Facebook. I checked this morning, and there's actually 18. So kind of by filing this lawsuit, it seemed like they generated more publicity for this opposition group.
Yeah, 18 likes for this Facebook page, and the video in question isn't there any longer, right?
Right. Yeah. So I agree with the caller. I mean, if the city really wanted to address this issue, they could have, you know, put out a public relations campaign about the use of these security officers rather than, I guess, trying to go through these back channels.
Lance Dixon with the Miami Herald. Have you ever come across any other instances of city governments pursuing legal action against the social media platforms because of the use of logos, trademarks, copyrights by critics?
Not particularly. And I kind of checked in the local courts and even, you know, just kind of federally to see if some stuff had come up in like the Florida Southern District. And it seems like for the most part it's individuals who see these different kind of spoof or like fake accounts on Instagram in particular, but sometimes on Facebook. And it's kind of people just like taking photos from their different profiles and kind of placing them in these different accounts and occasionally making some disparaging comments. But I haven't really seen it from any kind of city or county or any kind of governmental entity. And it seems like when it comes to interacting with social media and kind of making these claims of defamation or harm or anything like that, it's a kind of new territory, I think, for legal folks.
A new territory for legal folks, but one, Jessica, the public, certainly the media, we've gotten hypersensitive to, I think in no small part because the tweeter-in-chief in the Oval Office, President Trump, and his use of social media, we've become much more attuned to how ideas and reputations can get shaped or ruined based upon a post. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, the city obviously wouldn't have filed this if it was, you know, if they didn't believe that it really was harming their brand and their image. But at the same time, it is a little bit troublesome. I mean, this account wasn't really saying anything too outrageous or outlandish, and there's some real questions about, you know, whether this suit will violence critics in the future.
Yeah, and so what's the next step for this particular lawsuit, Jessica?
Well, the judge has given Facebook and Instagram until September to respond. I mean, those are companies with huge legal presences, so I'm sure that this may be dragged on for quite a bit longer.
Yeah. And, Lance, what about the pursuit to fulfill these police vacancies at the heart of the criticism in Coral Gables?
Well, that'll definitely continue, and obviously the city is going to be going into its budget process soon to kind of set up for the next fiscal year. So it remains to be seen if they'll make any additional push to kind of boost recruitment efforts or anything like that. But the message that they've continued to send is, look, we're working on it, we're doing what we can, but these things take time. And obviously, if you're the person living on the street and somebody down the block from you just had their car broken into. Yeah. Sure, yeah, I guess it takes a while to get these recruits in, but I'm still seeing some of these effects, so it's a little closer to home for them.
Lance Dixon covering the city beautiful, Coral Gables, for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our studios in Doral. Lance, great to have you back on the Roundup again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jessica Lipscomb, reporter for the Miami New Times. Jessica, nice to have you on the program as well. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Finally, on the Roundup this week, where we come from and where we go. This week, the Census Bureau released some new data, pretty interesting, showing where people are coming from to live in South Florida and where some South Floridians are leaving our confines to go somewhere else. Well, here we go. Miami is living up to its reputation as the sixth borough of New York City. Between 2011 and 2015, the biggest source of new residents moving to South Florida, Brooklyn, New York. Outside of the U.S., the Caribbean and South America remain the places where most people coming to South Florida hail from originally. Now, we're not just a community of imports here, certainly. We are actually exporting plenty of people as well. In fact, the biggest source of new residents to the Orlando area is South Florida. That'll do it for the Roundup. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato, our digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. Our program director and technical supervisor this week, Peter Maritz. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.